The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
And I'm Gofen Putubwele. There are about 193 countries in the world. In 89 of them, The Sandman is the most popular show on Netflix.
So this is the Neil Gaiman show, of course, based on his comic series. I have to admit, Gofen, I don't follow fantasy that closely, but Neil Gaiman's got a huge list of really successful books. I don't think there's anyone even close to him in the genre right now. What draws you to his work?
His books ask readers to trust him and step into this new world, and then the world always delivers. I think one of my favorites is his story, The Graveyard Book, where this baby, his parents are killed, and then he gets adopted by ghosts in a graveyard, and the story sort of unspools from there. Or the story Coraline, or the series American Gods. There's just so many stories that are kind of filled with these like fantastical tales that are really great.
How involved was he in the new Netflix adaptation of Sandman?
Super involved, which is one of the things that's very cool about it. This is not the situation where the author says, I'm selling the rights and hopefully they don't mess it up. He was getting dailies, like the shots of what they recorded every day. He helped on the script. He helped with casting. He was very, very involved. And I think that the result is something that is as expansive and dreamy as the rest of his canon.
We begin. In the waking world, which humanity insists on calling the real world. As if your dreams have no effect upon the choices you make.
I want to take you back to December of 1988. Where were you in your life? What happened or was about to happen?
I had just turned 28 years old. I'd been 27 that year. And my first DC comic had been published about a month before, 6 weeks before.
Okay. Oh, wow.
Black Orchid number one. And now Sandman number one is coming out. I go to America. I come to New York, where I meet Mike Dringenberg, who is the artist. And I met Mike for the first time there. And the two of us went out to Jim Hanley's universe on Staten Island, if memory serves, to do a comic book signing. And in front of us, we have piles of Sandman 1. We have about 13, maybe 14 young men between the ages of 16 and 22.
Okay.
Waiting for us to sign stuff, and we signed stuff for them. And then that was it. That was our Sandman number one signing. As big events go, it wasn't. And What I love is looking back on it as Sandman signings became bigger and bigger, but also became more and more inclusive. There was the point somewhere in year two where I realized that the lines were no longer exclusively male. And probably by year three, they were 50% female. And around that point, I would go to conventions and large, sweaty gentlemen would come over to me, grab my hands and say, "You brought women into my store. My comic book store had not seen a woman. You bring them in. You do Sandman. Let me shake your hands, man."
So can you explain just the premise of Sandman and who the main character Morpheus is and what his domain is like?
Of course. So the premise of Sandman is that there is a place that you go every night when you close your eyes, fast asleep. You are actually visiting a place called the Dreaming. And the Dreaming is ruled by Morpheus, King of Dreams.
I, Lord Morpheus, dream of the endless. Summon the fates. The three who are one. The one who is three. The Hecate.
Morpheus. It's been a while.
You look thin, love. Are you eating? Are you hungry?
Yes, but not for food. Look at him. He wants something.
You've found me out. I do want something. I need your help.
Help?
About 106 years ago, he was captured by a British occultist and imprisoned in a glass globe in a basement and prepared to outlive and outwaked his captors. And eventually, he escaped and discovered that his realm was in ruins. Our dreams have been partly ruined, and powerful dreams had escaped into the waking world.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%.
All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
One of the things that I love about your writing is that it feels so, for me, it feels like I get into a plane and then it like takes me up really, really high and there's just so much space and so much like room to imagine. It just feels like there's so much, like even the way that you describe it, it's like you could say the premise of Sandman is about dreaming and dreams, but you know, you kind of like spin this beautiful tale and it makes me think like, wow, I want to soak up this world. I know that you did some journalism early on. Do you think that there are ways to bring that sort of like, I don't know if we call it fantasy or fantastical or roominess or space into nonfiction? Can we bring that sort of roominess into like what we consider factual?
I think we have to. The concept of suspension of disbelief is a fascinating one for me. And it continues to be sort of the thing that I look at and go, well, this is my engine. This is my place. My job is to make you believe in something that is not true and did not happen to people who do not exist, and to make you care about those people and those things that did not happen that I'm just making up. And if I do my job correctly, to send you back into your life feeling different, feeling like you've experienced something that you haven't experienced before, maybe even seeing the world a little bit differently. Episode 6 of Sandman, I took Kirby, Hal Baptiste, who plays Death, aside. You know, here we are, we're at the San Diego Comic Convention. And I said to Kirby, look, it suddenly occurs to me that I should have told you this a year ago. I should have told you this when we were shooting this. I should have warned you before you took the part. And I didn't. So let me just tell you now that for the rest of your life, people are going to come up to you and say, my son died, my daughter died, my grandfather died, my husband died, my lover died, my friend died, somebody that I cared about died. And I watched you in that episode, The Sound of Her Wings, meeting people.
As Death.
Mm-hmm. As Death. And it let me cope. I've been having people coming up to me for 30 years saying, your death got me through this. There is a real, in terms of suspension of disbelief, it's you're telling things, you're making things that aren't true. You're making these big, roomy things with space that are not true, and you're giving them to people in order to allow them to see, we hope, greater truths. What fascinates me is that suspension of disbelief is incredibly fragile, and it will pop on tiny things, and it pops in the same way on as fiction as nonfiction. You know, I remember reading an otherwise wonderful book in which somebody time travels back to the 17th century. They're in London, and they say, excuse me, where is such and such street? And the person says, oh, it's two blocks over. And the concept of the city block has not yet arrived in London. The idea that it would have arrived there in the 17th century with the tangle of London streets is impossible. And from that point on, much as I loved the book, I found it impossible to believe anything or take anything seriously. My suspension of disbelief has now gone. I was walking with you, and I have now let go of your hand, and I'm looking at you curiously. So I think that for journalism, for fiction, for non-fiction alike, the most important thing is just trying to cultivate trust. And you cultivate trust by a certain accuracy, by just checking your facts, by not telling people things that they know are not true, because then they're gone.
At some point in the series, we go to hell.
Tell us, why should we let you leave? Helmet or no, you have no power here. After all, what power have dreams in hell?
I wonder if you could just describe that domain.
Well, hell in The Sandman was very much inspired by Dante's Inferno. It is a place where you get things like the wood of suicides, and each tree in the wood was once a person who has died by their own hand. Mm. People everywhere, people make up the fabric of hell. The walls of hell are made of people. The buildings are made of people and of rocks and of thorns. It's huge, it's expanding. In Blake's phrase, the dark satanic mills definitely grinding away there. And over it all, ruling it all, is Lucifer Morningstar. Better to reign in hell than serve in heaven. And Lucifer is absolutely down for reigning in hell.
You talked about going into that suspension of disbelief, coming out and seeing your world in a slightly different light. What is it that in The Sandman, either you hope people see in a different light, or that you yourself saw in a different light at the end of having written it?
What fascinated me about hell always, I think I was about 11, and somebody asked a biology teacher of mine if he believed in hell. And he quoted somebody, it's actually a quote from somebody called the Abbé Mounier. And he said, I have to believe in hell because it is church doctrine that there is a hell. I am under no obligation to believe that there is anybody there. Mm-hmm. And I loved that. That for me was sort of the primary building block of hell. And I thought, okay, what if everybody in hell is there because on some deep, profound level, they want to be there. Mm. They believe they should be there. They are punishing themselves. That allowed me to begin to build a hell that I could work with in fiction. For me, you don't really write about hell. You write about hell in order to make concrete metaphors and ideas. So the idea of hell is a place of punishment. The idea that, you know, at one point Lucifer says, turns to Morpheus and says, well, you know, you have no power here. What power has dreams in hell? And he says, what power would hell have if those who are imprisoned here could not dream of heaven? And that, for me, that's what it's all about. It's like, why build a hell? Well, you build a hell so you can deliver those kind of ideas, so you can take those metaphors, so you can play with those stories, and you can actually make people think about them and go, whoa, okay, that's an idea. How does that apply to my life?
Last question is, in August 2022, your show is number one in 89 countries. in December of 1988. You're just about to, you're in a bookstore signing to, you know, a small crowd of people. How is the Neil Gaiman of 2022 different than the Neil Gaiman of 88?
I'm in some ways the same. I'm still curious and I still love making things. I think he was much more driven than I am. Partly, I guess, because I've done so many of the things that he dreamed of doing. You know, all these sort of things that have mean that I feel like I've actually written my name on the wall. And that if I die tomorrow, my name will have been written on the wall. It may not be written very large or very legibly or even anywhere that people can see it, but I know I wrote it. And he, as a 28-year-old, was going, I want to write my name on the wall. And I want to make good stuff. And I think if I just keep making good stuff, sooner or later, my name will have been written on the wall. And I'd love to be able to go back in time and tell him, I think he was probably right.
Neil Gaiman talking with our producer, Gofen Mputubwele. The Sandman, adapted from the Gaiman series of graphic novels, is out on Netflix. That's our program for today. Next week, get ready, because Jennifer Lewis will be joining us, and she's starring in the Showtime series, I Love That For You. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado and Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, and Gofen Mputubwele.
Along with Jeffrey Masters, Will Colley, and Michael May. And we had assistance from Harrison Keithline and James Napoli.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With three updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging and an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.